Welcome to episode 129 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and the guest on today's podcast is H.B. Lyle, whose The Irregular has just been published in the U.S. Bent's novel casts the fictional character of Wiggins, Sherlock Holmes' Irregular-in-Chief, alongside the real-life Vernon Kell, founder of MI5, Britain's domestic secret service, in a story that could very well have been ripped from the headlines of 1909 London. Wiggins' association with Kell is set in motion by the Tottenham outrage, where Constable William Tyler, who was Wiggins' best friend in the story, lost his life after a payroll robbery. Holmes does make a cameo appearance. After a meeting, the retired consultant detective introduces Wiggins to the refreshing novelty of Coca-Cola, which Holmes has shipped to him from America because, as of 1909, it was not yet available in England. Here's H.B. Lyle to talk about The Irregular. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I'm delighted to have H.B. Lyle on the podcast. His The Irregular has just been released in the United States, although it's been out for a few months in the United Kingdom. Welcome, Ben.
Hello.
With The Irregular, you've joined what can only be described as an august club of writers who've expanded Arthur Conan Doyle's universe of Sherlock Holmes, and that includes Laurie R. King, Anthony Horowitz, Lindsay Fay, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Bonnie McBird, among others. So how does that make you feel?
Obviously, I'm tremendously excited to have, you know, written the book and had it published at all, to be honest. And then particularly as well, it seems to be going down quite well in the States. You guys have, there's such a huge community of Sherlockians and sort of Sherlock Holmes fans. It's slightly strange for me because I haven't really, it wasn't really intended to be part of that canon, as it were, in that not that any of those books are pastiches themselves, but I wanted to tell the story of Wiggins rather than the story of Holmes.
And that leads me into my next question, because Wiggins is the street urchin in chief, recruited by Sherlock Holmes to lead what Holmes calls the Irregulars, which is his detective's eyes and ears on the street. So I'm curious, what led you to single Wiggins out as a character whose story needed to be told?
I can identify quite clearly the idea for this book initially, and it actually comes from the other end. It was in 2009, here in this country, there was a few events and a big book was published because that was the 100th anniversary of the Secret Service in this country, the British Secret Service, MI5 and MI6. And it was that that made... And then the idea came together. I said, oh, well, Wiggins would be about 30-ish, you know, give or take, you could fudge the number slightly, at the time that service was set up, and surely he would be the best qualified person to be a secret agent in London. So it came about through the sort of espionage, the real espionage facts, rather than me going back to the Holmes canon and, you know, thinking about who of those characters most intrigued me.
Well, I'm getting the feeling that you can see my questions, because my next question was that you fleshed out Wiggins' description, but your other main character, Vernon Kell, who established MI5, which is the domestic side of the Secret Service before World War I, was real, and that's who you mentioned in the book that was released in 2009. So was it difficult to pair a fictional character who has what can only be called significant literary baggage with a real historical figure?
I cut myself quite a lot of slack on that front. So obviously there's lots of real history in the book, and quite a few real people, including most notably, as you said, Vernon Kell, and his wife was also called Constance, so obviously as a major character in the book. So it's a historical novel in that sense, but I reason that because Wiggins is so clearly fictional, and Sherlock Holmes is obviously a fictional character and coming from a fictional universe, that no one could possibly accuse me of sort of trying to sell false facts or false news to the reader, because that Wiggins is a Holmes character means that it's obviously a novel, and so although. So I didn't feel I had to be that faithful historically. I mean, I'm pretty faithful about the detail of... I've tried to recreate 1909, and the geographical detail is all as close to the truth as I can make it. And likewise, the real events in the book, it kicks off with this payroll robbery, as you know, called the Tottenham Outrage, and that's all real what happened there, apart from Wiggins' appearance in it. But I didn't worry too much. I mean, sorry, the Vernon Kell of the book is my creation rather than an attempt at a recreation, if you see what I mean.
No, I see what you mean, and I understand that. I think that that early part of the 20th century is sort of underserved in fiction. It was certainly a hugely important time for what was going to happen 6 and 7 years later with the beginning of World War I. All of the things that happened then in 1909 and 1910 pretty much led to the war that kind of invented the modern era. So I think it's a fascinating time to set a book like this, and I thought I went. You know, I love a book that sends me to Wikipedia or to some of my history books to see. You know, like, oh yes, that really did happen. The Tsar really did visit in 1909. All that. Kind of stuff.
That was part of what I was trying to achieve, because one of my favourite books growing up, favourite series of books, was a series called Flashman by George MacDonald Fraser. And in that, he takes a real character from Tom Brown's school days, the bully, and puts him and writes him into Victorian history as a coward, a terrible coward. It's comedic. But what's great about that is that all the history is real, or most of the history, except what happens to your main character. And so you learn real things, what things that really happened, wars, etc. But through the medium of hopefully a sort of page-turning novel.
I have a Sherlock Holmes wonky query. And I'm curious about this because another character from the canon, Mycroft Holmes, Sherlock's older brother, is, assumed through the canon to have a significant, although completely fictional, role in England's intelligence community. So I was curious why he didn't show up in the story at all, or did you not want him to go into the real world of Vernon Kell?
I mean, I said that to myself. What I tried to do, as far as possible, is, and the conceit is that obviously I use history books to find out what really happened or to describe things, and then my other source, I use the Sherlock Holmes stories as if they're historical books. So the idea is I don't want to do things that obviously non-canonical, to use that word. So I wanted it to try to be consistent with, the canon of Sherlock Holmes stories. With Mycroft, again, my focus, one of the reasons behind wanting to write this story was very much that Wiggins was a working class, but beneath working class, sort of blue-collar hero that we don't have very many of in spy fiction, certainly in the UK. And so I wanted to put Holmes in it as part of his origin, a part of Wiggins' origin story, but I didn't want to get too embroiled with a Holmesian world, as it were. And I can say it's I can be consistent with the canon because you could quite easily say that by 1909 Mycroft would have retired or possibly be dead. You might have to read a later installment of the series to find that out. But
I don't think the date of his death is ever. I don't think the date of his death is ever established. But he did seem to have health problems. Supposedly, he was very overweight. So,
yes, exactly. I mean, what's funny is in the 80s, and my knowledge of Sherlock Holmes. My brother was the big Sherlock Holmes fan in our family, and had the big annotated Sherlock Holmes. You know, with the Baring Gould edition, with all the, you know, people trying to establish what really happened along with the stories themselves. So he knows it all much better than I do. But obviously I was a big fan. But I was also a huge fan of the Jeremy Brett series.
Oh, yeah.
In the 1980s and 90s. So, which is, you know, perfect television as far as I'm concerned, and a pretty much perfect rendition of Holmes. And so I sometimes get confused in my own mind about the about how they would portray characters and whether they were faithful renditions from the books. So yes, in the it was played. Mycroft was played by Charles Grey in the television series, and so I always picture Mycroft looking like Charles Grey. He was fairly portly at the time.
Well, you touched on this in the answer to the previous question, and once again, I'm wondering if somehow you can see into my computer. But class, or as we say now, especially in the Democratic United States, socioeconomic status, with all of its baggage and expectations, is a significant factor in your story of Kell's search for foreign, specifically in this book, German skullduggery in London. And Kell needs people who know the streets. But he's strongly encouraged by his bosses to employ men from the better classes. And I thought you did a really good job showing that without being preachy.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, because obviously that is a point I wanted to make, because that's true both in historically in the British Secret Service and the spies they employ, and in the fiction about it. It's, you know, people of a certain class. So I wanted to show that. But you're quite right. What I didn't want to do is be seen to be making that point particularly. You know, as you said, try to illustrate it without saying this is terrible.
Well, the way you did it, I mean, I thought the contrast was the subtle contrast, like the implications of how lawbreakers are punished. If someone is an aristocrat or even aristocrat adjacent, they seem to be able to avoid the unpleasantness of the criminal justice system, whereas Wiggins takes a swing at a police officer while he's inebriated and ends up in jail for 60 days.
Yes, I mean, and that's still true today, of course. It's not necessarily so linked to quite as linked to class, perhaps, as then. But nevertheless, as someone once famously said, British justice is open to all, just like the Ritz Hotel. You know, you get a different class of justice than you do if you've got money than if you don't. And obviously that is true in America, too, I believe.
Oh, no! See, it isn't so.
I mean, I think in America, you're probably less likely to call it class.
I know, that's why we invented socioeconomic status.
Yeah. But yeah, so obviously that is, you know, that's, I think in an early draft of the novel, it was probably a bit more prevalent, that idea of the class thing. But then it's so evident from who the people are that you don't really need to labour the point. What I found when I was drafting, I didn't need to labour it, because Wiggins is obviously smart, and if he was born into the same kind of family as Kell, he would be in a totally different position.
And you also work in the women's working to get the vote with Constance. She's a suffragist, not a suffragette, which I thought was a nice distinction. Thank you for doing that. And it shows that she is smart and sort of goes against the preconceived notion of the time. So I think that that's important, too, to add to the novel.
Thank you. Yes, that's one of the things I wanted to do. I didn't... so often I find in this genre, or thrillers and mysteries, that the female characters end up being sort of bait or motive or reasons for the male characters to do things rather than having particular agency of their own. And that's a particular danger in historical fiction, because it was much harder in that time for a woman to be, active in military matters, for example, or be running around with a gun. You want to try and maintain some sort of historical authenticity, but at the same time, I wanted to try and, make sure that the women weren't just sitting around in drawing rooms drinking cups of tea.
Although I think Constance would have been comfortable doing that, because she was of that class where she had the luxury to be a suffragist.
Yes, exactly. I tried to make that point again, that I was often a middle class, even though, of course, it was right and perfectly correct and supported, should be supported. Nevertheless, a lot of the people who were in it were of a certain class and didn't have many of the other problems that most poorer women had.
And I thought, I thought your depiction of the poor and sort of what happened to them in Victorian, and of course in 1909 we're in the Edwardian era, which is kind of an extension of the Victorian era. But, the poor and orphan children were so really deeply vulnerable. And to me, so it's no wonder that Wiggins, early in the book, took it upon himself to escape the orphanage when he was 7 and to, get others to follow in order, one of the things that's happened is they become the irregulars. But it really was a grim world if anything happened to you.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I think that's the truth of it, is that you can see, obviously, this is something that isn't addressed in Sherlock Holmes, the Sherlock Holmes stories at all. They're just a group of kids. But when you think about it, that's a group of kids living rough on the streets. That's not a comfortable place to be.
And I think the streets of London in 1909 were really, truly mean streets. I mean, literally and figuratively.
Obviously I wasn't there then, but I certainly wanted to give that impression. That there's quite a build-up in this country at the moment, a very regrettable build-up of nostalgia. And, I mean, the British have always been cursed to some extent with the nostalgia, but days gone by, Britain obviously in 1909 was at the height of its imperial power, covered a fifth of the globe or whatever it was, and there's some people in this country that still look on that as a bit of a golden age. And the point I wanted to kind of make, lightly, if ever, of course it wasn't a golden age. It might have been a golden age for some people, but very few people. The rest, the most, struggled horribly.
And, of course, interestingly, they look at it as the golden age, but the seeds of Britain's empire's, disintegration were just beginning to be sown.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. It was going to go down the tubes very soon. I mean, it's interesting. I'm just finishing the second book.
Oh, you anticipated my next question.
Okay, I'll let you ask your next question.
Can you tell us what's next for Wiggins and Cal and the fight against foreign plots on English soil?
I don't want to give you too much detail away yet, because I've just finished the draft, so we'll have to do some editing to see the balance. But it takes place the following year, pretty much, and it's still mostly in London, although there is a foray into Germany, so we get some of the Foreign Service activity. What I'm trying to do with this book is just go a bit further with some of those themes and try and illustrate or play out in Wiggins more than anyone else that contradiction or conflict between being who he is and working for the system that perpetuates people in the position of who he is. So how comfortable or uncomfortable he becomes working for the state that he doesn't necessarily approve of. Obviously mixed up with that is action and daring do, as you'd expect. And the novel culminates, or nearly culminates, in one of the most spectacular and true events in the history of the East End of London, which is called the Siege of Sydney Street. And it was a gun battle on the streets between the army and a gang of anarchists. And that closes the story that sort of opens in book one with the Tottenham outrage. That's an arc that closes in Sydney Street a year and a half later.
So I ask this question of people that come to writing from different directions. Now, you were a writer before, but sort of the way I position the question is always, so you were a successful screenwriter, but what you really wanted to do was write a book. And because for anyone who's never written a book, it is such a long process. I think it's wonderful, but it is time consuming. So much more so than screenwriting, I think. So I wanted to ask that because, you know, you talk about story arcs, which is one thing that screenwriters bring to the party, I think. That you can have one arc begin in one book and end in another book, but the reader should realize that's like 3 or 4 years of work.
Yes. I mean, I'll just correct you slightly. I wouldn't call myself a successful screenwriter. What I was a development executive. So I worked in screenplays for companies such as Working Title and Fine Line Features. So I was a development executive rather than a screenwriter. So, but I worked with stories, worked in the film industry. So, yeah, that's why I talk about story arts and stuff, because I know all that screenwriting theory. I mean, subsequently, I have written the screenplay for The Irregular, but that was after writing The Irregular as a novel. I suppose it's the question how I came to novel writing.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I started writing short stories, and I wrote a novel off the bat while I was a film executive, so in my spare time. And then I went on to a creative writing MA. I guess you guys would call it an MFA. Mm-hmm. At the University of East Anglia, which is the sort of the big course in the UK, the one that Keshe Ishiguro went on and Ian McEwan, etc. So it's like the most high-profile creative writing course in the UK. And then I did that while still being a freelance film executive. And off the back of that, I wrote a kind of sort of more literary novel. It was the second novel. The first one was Junked. And then it was only later, it's about the same time, but I had the idea for The Irregular, but it took me a while to get to it because I then also did a PhD in how screenplays are developed in the UK film industry. But this is writing all the time. If I wasn't writing about screenplays, I was doing my PhD, and if I wasn't doing my PhD, I was writing my novels.
So you became a doctor in your spare time.
Thankfully, I got a scholarship to do my PhD, so I got funded by the government. So I got a maintenance grant to do that. Obviously, I didn't research my PhD full time, although I was paid to do it full time. So that's how I got away with that, really. But I think that writing begets writing, you know. So I started this second novel, and you start waffling, like, how am I going to get to 90,000 words? You know, how am I going to write 300 pages? And then you're about And then a third of the way in, thought, oh, okay, I can see the end. And about two-thirds of the way in, you think, oh, this is going to be 110,000 words, you know. And then you start cutting it back because you're writing too much. But my advice to other people to do it is read a lot, obviously, and, yes, just start small.
And you were a development executive, so you had to think in terms of story, because that's the other thing. It can't just be words. There has to be something attached to it, or it's not going to get you to – one sentence is not going to get you to the next one, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Well, certainly from my training as a development executive, that's true. I mean, one of the other things that I sort of manoeuvred myself into doing as part of being a development executive was sort of specialising in reading books to see whether they should be adaptations. So I've read a hell of a lot of books across a hell of a lot of different genres that I wouldn't have picked up for fun. So, necessarily. So when you asked earlier about the other sort of writers who've done, I'm not going to call them homes pastiches, but use that world. I know of those since writing The Irregular to do some research around the marketing of it, etc. But I haven't read any of those. And in the same way, I haven't, in my free time, I wouldn't necessarily have been reading sort of thrillers or crime fiction. But because most of my reading has been sort of prescribed by my job, I have read a lot of crime fiction. And so what happened was I ended up writing what can be described as a sort of spy thriller or mystery. And that wouldn't necessarily have been the case, say, 10 years ago, when I had sort of much vaguer ambitions before I went into the film industry of being a writer. My ambitions would have probably been more along the lines of, you know, writing the next Booker Prize winner or the National Book Award or something.
Although thrillers and mysteries are now getting nominated for the Booker, so there you go.
Oh, yes, and they always were in some way. So, I mean, I tend to, personally, because I come from the film industry, I tend to look on genre as a marketing category rather than as much to do with the actual book. So you get good books and you get bad books, and they can be about spies or murder or love affairs, or, you know, life on a Russian steppe. they can be good or sort of good or okay or bad.
That's
how I look at it.
Well, I think The Irregular falls into the good category.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope you and many other people agree.
And I want to thank you again, Ben, for your time and for talking to us and for telling us about The Irregular and how the world of created by Arthur Conan Doyle actually gets to meet up with the real world. And it makes a really good story. So I thank you for writing it.
Oh, you're welcome. And that's the most important thing to me, that you think it's a good story. You know, that's the point. That's what it's meant to be.